Hi, this is Nancy Giles. What were the underlying causes of the Newark riots of 1967? And how did they affect Newark and the nation? With 40 years of perspective, what have we learned? Joining us, Eddie S. Glaude, Jr. He's a professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Max Herman is assistant professor of sociology at Rutgers University, Newark.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Thomas J. Segrew, professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania.
It's great being here.
Thanks. All right, gentlemen, how did the radio drama that you just heard evoke the African-American experience at the time? Do you feel like it really captured what was going on? And you want to talk a little bit about the issues that caused the riot? Eddie Glaude?
We hear in the radio a drama, a dramatic representation of the event, the circulation of perceptions, how these particular folk were perceived by those very people who were policing.
Sure. Max Herman.
Newark had a notorious history of police brutality against young African-American men. Prior to the arrest of John Smith, there had been several high-profile incidents where young black men had been arrested, detained, and beaten by the police. Lester Long in 1965 comes to mind.
Part of what we see with Newark, of course, is the impact of post-war suburban migration. We begin to see the white flight to the suburbs.
Right. It was a predominantly white town.
Oh, absolutely. In 1940, 80% of the urban population in Newark was white.
Italian?
Well,
mixed.
Mixed.
Okay.
But by 1967, the majority of the population in Newark is actually African American. At the same time, we see that Newark is experiencing a kind of process of deindustrialization. We see the departure of General Electric. We know that the tanneries that polluted the Passaic River is disappearing. The brewing industry is leaving. So we see all of these, shall we say, structural realities impacting how one experiences Newark as an urban space. At the same time, we know that 38% of black men between the ages of 16 and 19 were unemployed at the time. And so there's this confluence, not only with regards to deindustrialization, not only with regards to these demographic shifts as a result of migration out and migration in. We also see the impact of policing of communities. We also see the effects of urban renewal, quote unquote, on these particular communities. And so it was just simply a powder keg ready to explode. And so we see that there is a sense in which the police don't understand themselves as being in the role of protecting this particular group of citizens. In fact, they see them as animals. They see them as criminals, as those who actually jeopardize the stability of the country.
Get in your house.
I was in my house.
Go ahead. Right now. Move.
Till I came outside my house now.
Go on. Move. What? Get in your house.
Why do you people talk like that? I'm not doing anything.
Just go on. There's been people killed here today.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not doing anything.
Get in your house.
You talk like I'm your dog. Like you talking to your dog that's in chains.
Black people didn't have political power in the city. They didn't have political representation in the city. And this was in addition to the police-community relations problem, was a major factor. You had the appointment of James Callahan to the Newark School Board. He was a guy with a high school degree who was chosen over a fellow Wilbur Parker who had a CPA, one of the first black CPAs in the state of New Jersey.
Can we talk a little bit more about Newark in the context of what was going on in the country in the summer of 67?
Survey research in the mid-1960s showed that African Americans distrusted local government the most. Many looked to the federal government, especially in the aftermath of the civil rights legislation of 64 and 65, as an ally. Local government, which was often disproportionately white in cities that were gaining black population, seemed to be distant, removed, hostile to the interests of the African-American population. And that distrust played out on the streets. You know, folks were responding, you could say, to the political failures of municipal governments by turning to forms of protest, including demonstrations and rioting.
Mm-hmm. And we have to place it within the broader context of black power.
Right.
We know that by 1965, 1966, there's a discourse, there's a cry for black power. We know in October of 1966 in California, the Black Panther Party.
Well, even right before that, in February of 65, Malcolm X is assassinated.
1965, of course, is the year of the Watts
right.
Rebellion. And so there is this kind of shift in the very tone, in the very style, in the very ways in which African Americans are engaging in struggle. And so we begin to hear languages of self-determination, languages of black love, talk about black power in the sense of black political empowerment. So when you join this kind of ideological shift on the landscape with the kind of political realities that reflect a kind of fundamental mistrust of local government, the reality of being disenfranchised in one's local spaces, how black power then seeks to mobilize constituencies in order to seek power, in order to, pursue the interest of communities within which one finds oneself. This becomes the kind of equation for the very interesting place that Newark becomes, because I like to think of Newark as a black power city.
Mm.
And so it has everything to do with the Newark riots in 67, the ascendance of Ken Gibson. Behind Gibson, of course, is Newark and Leroy Jones, who would later become Amiri Baraka. Then we begin to see a black political class emerging with an interesting ideology that doesn't get broken until Cory Booker's election.
In the midst of the riots in the late 1960s, Jimmy and Grace Lee Boggs, who were some of the great theorists of black power, Jimmy Boggs said, "The city is the black man's land." And so much of what was happening in the riots in Newark and elsewhere was African Americans claiming turf, saying, "This is our territory. We should determine our own fate and our own future and not have it imposed on us by these outside forces, whether it be the police or whether it be a white city council or a white city government."
Gentlemen, we're talking about the riots, and I want to throw this question first to you, Eddie Glaude. Are riots ever successful, or do you think they just end up marginalizing the affected communities?
Right. It all depends on what we're claiming as success.
Okay.
Because in some ways, when we think about the kind of convergence of forces that lead to, shall we say, urban rebellion, those forces are reflective of a condition of living on the part of many people who happen to be voiceless. And oftentimes, these forces emerge or erupt in the way that they do, not in any directed fashion. Right. And so in some ways, riots or rebellions are the expression of those who oftentimes are voiceless. And then folks swoop in to try to give it direction. One of the interesting things that we know about this period of rioting is that it did for a while bring urban policy onto the scene. It became a crucial feature of presidential politics, a crucial feature of American politics generally. And when we see what happens when folk who are poor, who are locked out, who are black and brown, and on the margins are locked out and not on our radar screen, it takes a natural disaster like Katrina to wash them up and bring them onto the radar screen again.
I'd say one of the most striking differences between 1967, the longest of the long hot summers, there were more than 160 of these riots and rebellions around the country in that summer, including Newark. The biggest difference is, for the past 30 or 40 years, we've just had a handful of such riots and rebellions. Why? Because there was a sense of the possibility of change in 1967. People believed that taking it to the streets would transform the political system of the United States or the political system of Newark in ways that reflect an optimism that's now gone and buried in large segments of the African-American community and large segments of white America, for that matter. And so it may seem perverse to think about the riots as expressions of a kind of a hopefulness in the possibility of change, but they were coming at a moment when people really did believe taking it to the streets could have an effect. You could change the status quo, and you could change it by turning the system on its head and forcing a rupture.
Eddie said earlier that he likes to see the cities as the black power cities, but there are a lot of white folks out there who resent that terminology and have this sort of mythologized sense of what the city was like, the good old days prior to these political changes, and they would strongly resist this notion of the cities. And even the concept of calling it a rebellion raises the hackles among a lot of the white people that have this vision of the city prior to 67.
Tom Sugru, I'm wondering, how can the city be perceived without marginalizing the African-American community and romanticizing the all-whiteness of the good old days? Through these rebellions, was there a sense of maybe two different sides working together?
There was polarization in the aftermath, but I think there are ambiguous outcomes. On one hand, in the aftermath of the riots, public officials and corporate leaders bought what at the time was called riot insurance. That is, they tried to incorporate African Americans into the system in a way that would diffuse the discontent. And that led to some concrete gains. Mm-hmm. The number of black public employees in cities all over the country skyrockets in the aftermath of the uprisings because they realize there are costs to the systematic exclusion of African Americans from the political and economic system.
Right.
The flip side, however, is that there is a dramatic ramping up of the polarized politics of law and order.
Absolutely.
And it's one that comes down very heavily on urban African Americans, especially young black men. So the 1970s, you know, in the decade after the riots, witnesses a significant and steady increase in the number of African-American men who are incarcerated. The rise of the carceral state, the prison industrial complex, is one of the unintended consequences of the climate of discontent and rebellion in the 1960s.
So, 40 years later, do you think that John W. Smith would be dragged from a cab and beaten and put in jail the same way that he did, that was maybe the spark to initiate the Newark riots?
I think it all depends on where the cab is stopped.
Interesting.
If the cab is stopped downtown Newark, maybe not.
But would it start a riot is what I'm wondering.
I mean, it all depends. It might not start a riot, but it would certainly start the traditional racial theater of American politics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you think about the young man who was recently stopped and shot on the eve of his wedding night
in New York City.
That's
right. New York.
And we think about what followed. What followed were a series of protests, what followed were a series of very heated public exchanges, the traditional racial theater.
And just so that it's clear, one of the officers that was a shooter was an African-American
officer.
That's right. So it's become clear since the 60s that once they go into the police precincts, they start bleeding blue. Whether or not that treatment would then result in a kind of massive demonstration, I'm not sure today, precisely because of the kinds of class cleavages that Tom Segura just laid out.
I hate to say it, but I'm not sure that the kind of unity exists within the African-American community as it did back in the 1960s.
I wonder if there's always been sort of a misperception that all black people think alike and are of the same community and have the same concerns. I don't think anyone would consider that of white people.
I mean, even during the quote riots, there were some people that were out there that had a clear sense of political purpose. And then there were others that simply wanted to get a radio or a television set. Junius Williams, who was an activist at the time, mm-hmm. refers to the events as a riot/rebellion.
Hmm.
Some people were rebelling. Other people were rioting. Why would we expect that everybody out there would have a unity of purpose?
So now blacks are getting a little bit more involved in the political concerns of their communities. So once that happened and they gained access into the political sphere after the riots, it seems that they had many of the same problems as the white political machine. Eddie Glaude?
One of the ironies of African-American political classes taking over urban spaces is that they take over at the very time in which these spaces are deteriorating, when their tax bases are just simply being deracinated in interesting sorts of ways. So it's really, we always seem to come in one step late. And the very moment in which we take over cities, cities are in dire straits, and the federal government is turning its attention away from them.
That's right.
So the rebuilding process.
There's no cookies left in it.
So the rebuilding process is like immense.
We take over at a really interesting moment.
Yeah. Right? Some observers have called it the hollow prize. That is, African Americans assume the control of municipal government at a time when federal spending for cities is starting to plummet, at a time when the process of deindustrialization, the flight of capital and business out of cities has been going on now for 25, 30 years, at the same time that white suburbanization is continuing apace. So essentially you take cities, you drain them of their capital, you drain them of a sizable segment of the population that's contributing to the property tax base, take federal government away, and then you say, it's your problem now.
Good luck.
And then what's interesting too, this is, remember now, 1973 marks the end of the American century. Right? That is to say, this idea that American productivity, prosperity will last for 100 years, that we will continuously see a growth of the economy, shuts down.
That's right.
Everything collapses, right? So we have the oil embargo with the OPEC.
That's right.
We begin to see high rates of inflation, stagflation, all this stuff starts taking place, right? And so at this moment, we see economic realities. The nation has a cold. And whenever the nation has a cold, black America has the flu.
Or pneumonia.
And so what happens? We're coming in, taking over cities, whether it's Ken Gibson, whether it's Wilson Good, whether
Coleman
it's
Young.
Coleman Young. They're taking over cities that are literally, literally dying.
This really almost sounds like a conspiratorial pattern.
We have to see the kind of implosion of coalitions that brought Ken Gibson into office.
Can you explain that a little?
Kamosi Woodward has written a wonderful book, A Nation Within a Nation, which is a study of Amiri Baraka's role in Newark politics. We see that there's an interesting coalition behind Ken Gibson that has a broad ideological range, but at its center is a certain conception of black politics that's tied to a particular understanding of black power. And so part of what we see, right, is Ken Gibson getting in office, and there's certain expectations placed upon him
from these factions.
And when Gibson makes certain political choices in City Hall, political choices that are viewed by some as sellout, the coalition breaks, and then we see all sorts of things going on. What we see very clearly, Sister Nancy, is that black folk are just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Give them some power, they act funny. Mm. They start acting like folk with power. It's complicated, but we have to wrap our minds around it.
Would any of the white people in the room like to comment on that?
I agree with you. I think class politics become increasingly important because the inequality that is remaking America into a more unequal place in the last third of the 20th century is one that's playing out among African Americans and is playing out in cities like Newark. So what we see over that 30-plus years after the riot of 1967 is the emergence of an increasingly vocal and powerful African-American middle class, mm-hmm. many of whom are working in the public sector or in publicly funded sectors of the economy and have certain interests that are at stake in the political system. You've got a growing segment of the population that's marginalized from the political process altogether. They're where they were prior to 1967 in lots of ways. They're disaffected with what they see as out-of-touch folks who don't really understand what's happening in the streets. And many of the police-community relation issues that were alive and important in 1967 change their color, but they don't go away. Tension between especially poor and working class African American men and an increasingly multicultural police force are still live and real. Police community relations remain, I would say, perhaps the touchiest issue in big cities around the country, even though the face of the police force has changed.
Back to Newark these days. We've got Cory Booker as mayor. He's got some pretty formidable challenges in the wake of Sharp James and what he's dealing with right now. There's crime problems. There's killings. I mean, we all want Newark to be a successful city.
Well, part of what I think Mayor Booker has to do is to dare to be innovative and creative and imaginative in public, to step outside of the traditional ways in which Newark politics has taken place. And when I say the traditional ways, I'm thinking about not only Sharp James, but I'm thinking about the very ways in which politics takes shape in this city. We know that there are not only problems with crime, there's problems with regards to employment, there are serious problems with regards to education.
Right.
We know about the housing crunch. We know about the private sector and its challenges. We just recently, not too long ago, saw a piece in the New York Times about people thinking about Newark as a place to live, given the soaring rents and cost of living in New York City.
That's right.
So we know there are possibilities, but that we also know there are challenges. What I like to think of as Cory Booker as a post-soul politician.
A post-soul politician.
What I mean by that, I'm talking about a generation of African-American leaders who are going to emerge, who have no biographical experience with Jim Crow, who have had access to mainstream American society in ways that black America has never seen before. I mean, the fact that Cory is a Yale-trained lawyer, the fact that Cory has all of these connections to Wall Street, the fact that Cory decided to move into the more economically challenged areas in Newark makes him a peculiar bird. Mm-hmm. He sounds differently. He walks differently. And so part of what we need to do is to kind of understand that these voices coming out from this generation of leaders, that these folk will look and sound differently. They won't sound like those who were shaped in the context of the 60s. I like to think of the 60s generation as the greatest generation America's ever produced. I do know that the greatest challenge my generation faces, and I say this with Cory Booker in mind, is that we have the 60s to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. We have to deal with the symbolic significance, the shadow of trying to imagine struggle, imagine politics in the aftermath of this extraordinary explosion of civic energy.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing among the younger generation of black politicians like Booker are a return to a form of coalition politics that was really important in key moments in the black struggle for racial equality in the North. It's forming those unlikely coalitions, building bridges between community organizations, state and region-wide and nationwide organizations that made possible the kinds of larger scale structural reforms to improve the quality of life for African Americans. And those kinds of coalitions were harder to build for a generation after 1967, and they're easier to build on the part of people like Booker because they're not encumbered with all of the memories and all of the experiences of 1967.
And those coalitions are necessary. I mean, you cannot be a mayor of a city like Newark today without building those kinds of coalitions because, once again, the demographics are shifting. The Latino community is growing by leaps and bounds.
Right.
And
it's this not is part just of the, black and white.
Right, right.
Yes.
And it wasn't just black and white even back in the 1960s. We have to remember that Mayor Gibson was elected not just on a black power slate, but was elected and promoted by the black Latino coalition in the city at the time, Hilda Hidalgo and others.
Well, gentlemen, you've been very polite. You've listened to my agenda and my questions. And now I just want to, before we say goodbye, I want to open it up to you. Anything that you'd like to add about the Newark riots, about Newark from 67 to 2007, Newark today? Anyone? Let's start with Max Herman.
We have this real legitimate issue about the future of the city. When you bring the middle class back, things are going to change, and there are deep and abiding concerns that some people, the poor people, will be displaced from the city. The people who stuck it out for the 40 years after 67 are now worried that they are going to be booted out of their own city. The mayor has to strike a balance, not just in terms of racial politics, but in terms of class politics between those middle-class people that are coming in and those working-class people that have struggled over the years to keep the city alive.
Tom Segrew?
Newark and the other uprisings of 1967, of those long hot summers, was an expression of a real battle for the soul of America. It was the result of a failure of institutions from city government on up, from the economy, to provide opportunities, equal opportunities for African Americans. It was a moment of real hope, a possibility of change, but at the same time, a recognition that change was not going to come just by people acting out of goodwill. It would have to be forced on a society that was only moving very, very gradually toward the inclusion of African Americans.
Mm. Eddie Glaude Jr., want to bring it home?
There's this striking moment in the radio drama that began our discussion. And it's the fifth day, and the mayor declares that it's done. The city is done.
Mayor Adonizio, what is your assessment of the situation now?
It's all gone. The whole town is gone. It's all over.
The riots of 1967 marked, in some significant way, this low point, even though it had all of this extraordinary possibility as it tried to push the country to accept African Americans, particularly Newark. There's this sense that the 1967 riots in Newark sealed this city's fate. And it's been living in the shadow of 67 ever since. But what we want to say is that Newarkers have been resilient, and that they are opening up the future for possibility. With the election of Cory Booker, that's not to say Cory Booker is a savior. He's definitely not that. We need to hold him accountable. But what we see since 67 is that Newark is a city that has all the potential in the world. So I only think that this is going to be an extraordinary place. I can't wait to see Newark 10 years from now.
That's wonderful. It's an honor to speak to you three once again. Eddie Glaude Jr., professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University. Glaude's new book is In a Shade of Blue, Pragmatism and the Politics of Black America. Dr. Max Herman, assistant professor of sociology at Rutgers University, Newark. He is currently working on a second book entitled Summer of Rage, Newark, Detroit, and the Summer of 67. And Thomas Segrew, professor of history and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. He has just finished Sweet Land of Liberty, the unfinished struggle for racial equality in the North. Gentlemen, this is fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Quite welcome. Thank you.
This has been wonderful.
I'm Nancy Giles, and thank you for listening.
5 Days in July was supported by a grant from David and Kathy Holmes. the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, a state partner of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations in this radio program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities or the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Sponsored by Algyra, a center for contemporary art in Newark, New Jersey, where the video installation 5 Days in July by Chuck Schultz and Esther Podemski opens October 2007. Special thanks to the director of Algyra, Mr. Victor Davson. We're also grateful to consultant Kevin Mumford, author of Race, Rights, and Riots in Newark, A New Political History, Judy Maurer and Mary Ruth Tomasiewicz from Phantom Audio, Charles Morrow Productions, LLC, Matt Brown, Michael Cumstey, John Diaz, Bernard Drayton, Ed Fogarty, Jerry LaRosa, Mark Nasdor, Christine Vogel, and actors Risharda Abrams, Kim Brockington, Sean Cullen, Michael Early, Charlie Kevin, and Tom Shaw. For more information on 5 Days in July, please contact us at 5daysinjulyradio@gmail.com.